Our guest today is Britain's most decorated diver, Tom Daley. A real national treasure, today the athlete and presenter is going to be talking us through his Olympic gold medal winning mindset, how he practices mindfulness, including his world-famous knitting, and sharing some insight into his family life as a married father of one. Okay, so welcome, Tom.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
Yeah, no, I'm doing good. You know, it's a little bit rainy outside, but I've got a bit of fresh air, got the bike here, so it was all good.
Nice, I like the optimistic outlook.
Yeah, I think you just got to get outside and get moving no matter what.
Definitely. I guess on that note, and I like to start off the podcast like this, by asking you, like, what one thing in your life right now are you grateful for?
Oh gosh, I guess there's so many things that I'm grateful for, but one thing I think is my family. You know, my family are always there to support me, my husband and my son. No matter how much he doesn't like to sleep in the mornings, I'm still so grateful for him. And just, I think being a parent allows you to have a completely different outlook on life, and you start to see the world through a fresh set of eyes, and everything seems new and exciting and fun again.
Definitely. How has becoming a parent changed you?
Oh God, in so many ways, becoming a parent changed me. I feel like becoming a parent opens up a whole new section of your heart than you never knew actually even existed. And you can feel things so much deeper and so much more of a personal and meaningful way. And I think the biggest thing that I've learned since becoming a parent is a sense of perspective of what really matters most. And that perspective allowed me to do better in diving and do better in my life, because I realized that all of the stuff that goes on and all of the things that I used to get really either bent out of shape about, or I used to worry about or stress about, you realize that what matters most is that your child is happy and healthy, and then everything else kind of, you know, fades into the distance a little bit, and you start to realize what you actually have time for and what you were just doing because you felt like you had to. So I think it just allows you to prioritize things in your life in a completely different way.
Definitely, that's beautiful. And your husband?
Yes.
I mean, I've seen him on, you know, YouTube and so on. He seems like an inspiring guy. Has he had an impact on your life?
Oh, huge. I mean, I met Lance, my husband, now husband, back 9 years ago now. We're coming up for our fifth wedding anniversary. And, you know, has had a huge impact on my life. And just being able to share your life, I feel like we're a team. And I think that's something that's really special about, you know, marrying someone that you feel like you can create a team with, where you know that no matter what, that he's got my back. He is so supportive. He understands what it takes to be the best at what you do, because he works in the film industry and is working extremely hard to do the best that he can. I was in sport doing the best that I can. And I think having that understanding of the highs and lows of what goes on when you're at the top of your field is extremely important to be able to relate to your other half. And with Lance in that, I just felt like I always had, like, I felt like previously I couldn't really talk to any of my teammates about some of the things that I had been feeling, especially after London 2012, competing in front of a home Olympics, then being able to win my first ever Olympic medal. It was something that I'd always dreamed of and visualized for the longest of times. And to finally have won that medal, and what came afterwards, I wasn't really expecting the massive down and the massive, you know, they call it post-Olympic blues, because it does happen where you achieve your dream and you succeed, and then you don't really know what comes next, and you don't know how you're going to deal with the next 4 years building into the next Olympic Games. And I couldn't really talk to my other divers on the team saying, like, look, I've just won an Olympic medal, but like, I feel like the worst and the saddest that I've ever felt in my life. I feel like I'm lost, because I feel like they would just say, oh, well, you just won an Olympic medal. What are you talking about? We didn't win one. Like, just get over it. Whereas with my husband Lance, when I met him, that was the first thing that we connected on, was he won an Academy Award or an Oscar back in 2009. And when he won that, he had that similar thing of like riding on a high, but then all of a sudden having to get back to it, and then the weight of expectation and the pressure. And it was really nice to be able to not have to explain myself to someone, and being able to, like, you know what? Yeah, I've been through that.
So there's a few things you said that I think are really important, and I'd like to touch on them a bit later. Yeah. But I wanted to stay with your relationship quickly, if you don't mind. Like, because you're both really, obviously really busy. You have careers that obviously, you know, require a lot of energy and time, but you have, from what I can tell, a great relationship. Which requires, I guess, paying attention to each other. You, like you mentioned, being there for each other. How does that work for you both? Like, how do you make sure that happens?
You know, it can be, one thing is that it's great to have two people that are very much like-minded in the way that they want to do the best that they can. But also that becomes a challenge of figuring out, how do we both get the best that we can out of our careers when we also have a child, and then we have to alternate and balance, like, what, just little practical things of like, who's going to do the nursery drop off, who's going to pick up, who's going to wake up in the morning with Robbie, who's going to organize the dinner so the other one can do a phone call. So it's always just about a lot of planning. And I think the most important thing is always communication, always being able to, if, and there's a few things that we've done in our relationship, which I think is why, as we go more and more in time in our relationship, we get stronger and stronger. And one is having that constant communication with each other. If something annoys us or something isn't quite right, we will say, I mean, there's no like being like silent treatment. There's none of that. It's like, you know, you come out and say it so that you can fix things, because a lot of the time people don't realize that the other person is annoyed or the other person is frustrated at something. And to combat that, what we started doing was, every night when we got into bed, we would ask each other what the best and worst part of our day was, to be able to bring some, like, to be able to talk about our day because we're so busy, but then also be able to say something that we found that was really exciting. And if we had forgotten to tell each other that happened in our day, or even if it was just a sweet moment between Lance and I, or between us and Robbie, or whatever it may be. And then also the worst part of our day, where it could be something as simple as, I don't know, I tripped up the stairs, or you said something that I did, I felt like, or you did something that wasn't quite up to my liking, or I had like some bad news, or I just had a bad diving day, whatever it is. And just to be able to talk about that and never go to bed mad at each other. And I think that was the biggest thing that allows us to constantly get the best out of our careers and our family personal life.
What that speaks to me, that is, you know, a good relationship doesn't mean it's all roses and shiny, happy faces all the time. But it's like authenticity, it's openness, it's communication. There is some interesting research, though, that was done around successful relationships and relationships that, let's call it, aren't successful. And it comes down to the ratio between positive interactions and negative interactions, which is really interesting. So I guess that comes, it probably speaks to paying attention, but it's about appreciating the other and you know, being kind and generous. Does that speak to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's lots of occasions where, you know, I think there's also that thing of, if we both want to achieve something, or we both have an idea, we both figure out how we can help each other to create, make that dream come true. Like, for me, Lance did sacrifice a lot of his career to be able to allow me to achieve my dream of winning an Olympic gold medal, because it was time sensitive. I couldn't travel around the world. I had to be in one place to be able to train consistently. So there was those sacrifices. And then in this year, since the Olympic Games, I've then been doing the same for him. He's been in Canada filming a TV show, and I've been out there with Robbie and bringing him back and forth. So there's been lots of things that we've had to sacrifice and adjust and make time for each other. And I do think, like you say, the positive and negative interactions, you just have to, I think you get more positive interactions if you are able to sort out the negative things really quickly and not sit on them and wait and get, let them manifest and get bigger and bigger and bigger. The sooner you sort them out, the easier it is to get back on track with any relationship, because, and like you say, no relationship is ever perfect and easy. There's always things and bumps in the road that you have to figure out. But if you allow yourself the chance to speak to one another and be open and honest about stuff, then that really allows it to get sorted faster.
Definitely. It requires, you know, it's an ongoing active commitment to be aware and, you know, pay attention and be intentional, rather than just getting stuck in habitual ways of being with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about, like you say, just paying attention to when people are having a bad day, or if something's going wrong, or something's stressful. And when you, like, one thing that I think we're both really good at is, if one of us sees the other one is stressed, we'll try and do something to take something off their plate, whether it be what they would usually be doing in the evening, or if it would be something that we knew that they had to do, but we could do it for them. Yeah. Like, I think that's something that is, that has been really good, actually, because occasionally we'll have to step in and help the other person and put something that we have that isn't as time sensitive aside.
Great. I want to chat about the Olympics. I mean, it would be silly not to. Obviously, you are a gold medal Olympic champion. I mean, that's amazing. I'd like to speak to about what happened thereafter as well. But first of all, can you describe, just like as best you can, describe what it felt like in that moment when you realized, you and Matty Lee, that you were Olympic gold medalists?
It was one of those moments that I dreamt of for such a long time, from as early as I can remember. Initially, it was to go to the Olympics. Then it was to win an Olympic medal. And then it was to win that Olympic gold medal. That was the one title out of everything, you know, national, European, world, Commonwealth, like World Cup, even World Series. I'd won all of those, but it was the Olympic title that had eluded me for so long. And after 20 years of diving, I remember going into that competition. And there was something about that day that was, we woke up, got out of bed, and everything seemed to just flow. And from the very get-go, nothing seemed to get in the way. And if anything did kind of like get in the way, it was like, oh, I don't care. Like, and it was the first time I'd ever woken up, and it was just like I had these blinkers on of knowing exactly what I needed to do with Matty. And we had prepared for that day so many times in advance. We had done multiple rehearsals. I think over the in the weeks leading up to, we'd probably done about 14 competition day rehearsals, where we would do exactly what we would do, whether we would eat the same thing, we would get to the pool at the same time, making sure that we knew exactly what we had to do in the warm-up, all of those things. And we actually had breakfast with Adam Peaty, who's an Olympic swimmer for Team GB, and he said to us at the end of the breakfast, he was like, right, okay, let's go and get some golds, boys. And that day, we both ended up winning gold medals, like Adam, Matty, and myself. But I remember in the competition, it was this really weird, it was the weirdest competition I've ever been in some aspects, because there were no spectators because of COVID. So it was just teammates and other athletes, other diving athletes that were in the audience. So it was a very interesting crowd, because it wasn't like every dive looked great to them, because everybody knew what a good dive was and a bad dive was, and everyone was following the competition and knew what was going on. So every time we did a dive, we would come up and we would hear the reaction, not just from a crowd of people that would cheer anyway, but from a crowd of people that knew what they were looking for. So you got a very, very honest reaction to your dives as you came up. So you see people going before not doing such good dives, and it would pretty much be like really like nothing, and then you'd have cheers of like actual good dives. And I remember the first dive was IRIMA 1.5, and it was just a solid start, and the same with our second dive, and everything was just solid. The heat started to crank up in round number 4, when we hit one of our dives that sometimes could be a little bit ropey for us, and it was also the round in which the Chinese divers, who are our biggest competition, faltered a little bit. And all of a sudden, you can hear, like, we were actually two divers before the Chinese divers, and you could hear the audience when they hit the water go, oh, and like, you're like, oh my, I was like, oh my gosh, what's happened? But you've got to stay focused. We had our dressing gowns on, me and Matthew were just sitting there, and our cue to get up and get ready to go back on the diving board was after the Chinese divers. So we knew that when we were in the competition, we had to constantly see what they were doing in order to then go back up onto the diving board. And it was like then this battle of like, we were ahead, and then it was like they were catching up, or we were like this constant battle all the way through to that final dive. And going into that final dive, the way that the start list was ordered, it's completely random, but it just so happened that diver number 6, 7, and 8 were, or 5, 7, and 8 were the top end of the diving pack. Yep. So it was us, then Russia, then China. So it was like the business end of the competition was right at the end. So we knew that if we were going to have any chance at securing a gold medal, well, any medal, let alone a gold medal, we were going to have to put the gauntlet down and do the best dive that we'd ever done. And I remember running to the end of the diving board, and it was almost like in every other competition and every other dive, I'd felt nervous before. And it was that final dive where I just thought, you know what? We've worked our butts off for this. We have worked so hard to be in this moment, and we are prepared as we've ever been. And I remember standing there and thinking, you know what? This is so cool. I'm at my 4th Olympic Games. I'm a parent. I'm a husband. I'm a friend. I'm a teammate. And there's so much more to me than what this dive is about to be. And it was like all of a sudden, all of that pressure like just melted away. And I was like, I'm going to enjoy this. I've tortured myself through all of the training, the hard parts, and you dream for this moment of being able to stand and compete in this diving pool. And in previous Olympics, I tortured myself for it because I was so nervous and so worried about what was happening. And so it kind of took away from the enjoyment of the Olympic Games. So I remember just standing on that the end of that back of that diving board. I looked at Matty and I just gave him a little nod. And then all of a sudden, they're counting and we're running down the diving board, take off, spinning through the air. Everything feels great. We hit the water. I know I've done an amazing dive. But then I look, as soon as I hit the water, I look under the water and I look up at the surface to try and see what kind of splash Matty's made, if any. And I came up and I was like, I could hear everybody cheering and saw everyone in the crowd going crazy. And I was like, well, is that good? Is that really good? Is that like, okay? Is that safe? And I turned to Matty and said, Matty, like, how was yours? And he was like, yeah, it was okay. And I was like, okay, good. Okay, bad. And I was like, well, tell me, like, was it like 9 good, 10 good, 7.5 okay? Like, tell. And I was just getting a little bit like, oh my gosh. And then we were waiting and waiting for the scores to come up. And the scores came up and it was our highest scoring dive that we'd done in the competition. And we knew then that we had already gone ahead of Russia because they couldn't catch us. But China were the only team that could still catch us. And we walked around to the side of the diving pool to watch their last dive. And we knew that they needed a 9.5, a 9.5 and a 10 to count from the judges, which meant that they were going to have to pretty much do a perfect dive to go ahead of us. And just judging from the training previously, they hadn't been doing that kind of stuff, but we knew that they could. So when they hit the water and it was pretty much a perfect dive, I remember looking at Matty and I was like, no, we haven't done it. Like, that's like, we got to that point. And it was actually, I remember looking up at one of the judges and who they had put their score in. And then they looked at us and he kind of just did a bit of a, like a shake of his head, like a, and I didn't know if that meant they haven't done it or we hadn't done it or that's going to be close. And I remember all I was looking for, I didn't care what the scores were, whether it was 9.5, 10s or 9.5, I didn't care. All I was looking for was to make sure that when the Chinese scores came up in the bottom right hand corner, it said number 2. Because if it said number 2, that meant that we were number 1 still. And I remember the moment when the scores flashed up, I just remember turning to Matty, screaming, jumping onto him. And I couldn't comprehend what had just happened. And it was like, it didn't feel real. And I just felt like I almost like everything kind of like went, and I kind of almost like went floppy. And I was just like, oh my gosh, all of this hard work, all of this effort has come to this moment. And we did it. And for the first, and I remember standing on the podium in particular and the national anthem playing, and I thought that I was going to be able to belt out this national anthem at the top of my lungs. And all I was doing, I just was blubbering, crying, like so bad, like just crying. Matty was like, it's okay. But the next morning when I woke up was the first morning I've ever woken up with a true sense of peace, of like, you did, like, we've done it. There's the time that you've worked so hard for this your whole life and you have finally achieved everything you've wanted to achieve in sport. And that for me felt like that was the best moment. That was felt like the best moment was the next day waking up and having the medal on the side of my bed and just thinking, oh, wow, like that, we did it.
That's brilliant. There's been so many emotions going on that day. But you know, you've spoken about things like flow and focus and I guess mindset and visualization in terms of let's go out and win the gold and that kind of stuff. And it's probably speaks to a lot of the factors that are important for peak performance. But I'm curious to know, so you said the next day was like this day of, you know, absolute peace, and you've achieved this thing you've wanted to achieve for such a long time. What were the next few months like?
You know, the next few months, usually after the Olympics, you go pretty much straight back into training after maybe 2 or 3 weeks off. But before these Olympics, I decided with my coach that we were both going to take a year off. My coach, she's taken a year off and I'm taking a year off. So that was the first time where I knew that right afterwards, I wasn't going to have to go right back into training and right back into everything. Because I think that's the really difficult thing is that athletes often are really bad at giving themselves time off, space to breathe, rest their body and mind and be able to do something else. Because otherwise, you just feel like you're just going back into the same thing. And then you know that you've got, in this case, 3 years more to train. But it was like being able to take myself away from that and be able to be like, you know what, I'm going to step back and I'm going to give myself a chance to rest and recover felt really important, and it's something that I think has been the best thing for me and my mental health. Definitely. And my body has been able to, you know, take a step back and take a break, and also try other things and venture into other areas. Like for me, you know, knitting was something that I took up nearly, well, 2 years ago now. And that's been something that I would consider to be one of my superpowers.
Yeah.
Be able to have that mindfulness, that way of escaping, the way of finding calm. And post-Olympics, that kind of has become my new venture of creating knitwear design and taking something that I'm extremely passionate about and I find extremely mindful, and being able to do that for something and be able to try and pass on that feeling to other people by creating kits and being able to create things where people can make something themselves. And I've just, yeah, since it's been very busy, and it's kind of thrown like my life sideways compared to what I thought it was going to go. Like, you know, I had these ideas of like maybe going into like TV stuff, or you know, getting back into sport sooner, because I thought, you know, I'm going to be bored and want to get back into it. But actually being able to take the time out, spend time with family, spend time doing things that I really enjoy, has been a really nice change from every other Olympics. Because after each other Olympics, it was always so extremely different.
Yeah,
because 2008, I was 14 and, you know, I didn't know any different. I went right back into it and was loving it. 2012, I had a real bad struggle because I didn't know where I was going with my life. And I was 18 and all I'd ever done was train. Yeah. And I didn't really have a real life. In 2016, I won a bronze medal in the synchro, but the individual was the worst competition of my life. And so then I kind of came back with it with a bit more fire in my belly, and that was easier to come back. So I've kind of had every single emotion and every kind of version of what a post-Olympic feeling might be.
It seems like after each of your prior Olympics, there's been the next goal. So very goal focused.
Yes.
It seems like after this one, it's different. And you said life's sort of gone in different directions than I might have imagined. So what does that make you think of?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing since these Olympics is that I'm like one of the oldest, I am the oldest diver on the team. So there's already that feeling of, you know, diving is going to have to come to an end at some point. Yeah. When that is exactly, I don't know. But this year has given me like a taste of what that might be, how that might look. And, you know, I was speaking to Sir Steve Redgrave, who's like Britain's most successful Olympian. I don't know if he still is, but still one of them. Won 5 Olympic golds in 5 Olympics. And I just said to him, like, how did you feel when you first went to, or there was another Olympic Games where you weren't competing? How did that make you feel? And he said to me, like, you know, every time that an Olympic Games comes around, I wish I could be competing and think I should be competing. And why am I not competing?
Yeah.
But you also know that your body can't go on and on and on, and you have to figure out a time of when is that time that is going to be right to walk away, when is that time to be able to adjust what you are going to do in the sport. And that's kind of where I'm at right now, is figuring out, do I want to go right back in and do extra events? Do I want to just go back and do individual and synchro events, or just synchro? So there's all of these things that are going around in my head of like, how am I going to take what I've learned in this year and in the past 20 years of my diving career and either take it into a different direction away from sport, or take it into a different direction within sport. So it's given me a lot of time to think, but it's just, yeah, one of those things that you have to realize that at some point your body won't be able to do it. I can't be doing this when I'm 50 years old. So I have to figure out how am I going to transition out at some point.
But I like that. I think it's exciting. And, you know, this idea of moving towards the unknown, I think that's where life happens.
So yeah.
It sounds like you're in a good place.
Yeah, absolutely. And I embrace change, and I love the challenge of change, because, you know, change in early on in my diving career was something that used to really worry me and panic me. And I think it's mainly in these last 2 years with the pandemic that anything can change at any moment, and things can be taken away, moved and adjusted, and being able to roll with that and just be like, you know what? Okay, things have changed, and, you know, the goalposts are constantly changing in life. And, you know, I've had multiple things thrown at me in the Olympic year, whether it's concussions, COVID, a knee surgery. So there's always things thrown at me into the mix of how it, and being able to figure out exactly how to deal with them. I think the biggest thing for me has been visualization.
So that's really important. It's something I'd like to dig into a bit. how you navigate and approach like challenges and adversity. And I guess to begin that, you've mentioned that 2016 was like your worst.
Yes.
Well, that the day when you didn't win the gold when you were going to was like your worst day in sport, let's say. But you then went on to win the gold 4 years later. And I know that your husband said something that I think was really pivotal for you following that event. Can you remind me what that was?
Yeah. Going into those 2016 Olympics, I felt like I was at my physical peak, my mental peak. All of the preparation was like, it was like, I knew going into that I could win an Olympic gold medal, especially in the individual event. And I felt like I could go in there and I was more ready than I'd ever been in my life. In the prelim, an Olympic record, and I won, and I was just like, okay, this is my time. I'm meaning business here. And then the next day I came back for the semi-final, and there was just something that just was not clicking. Something was just not, it just was getting worse and worse. And like everything started to go wrong. And it felt like my whole world was crumbling apart, because I ended up finishing in 18th place, last in the semi-final, and not making it through to the final. Yeah. And I was just so devastated, not only to have worked so hard for those many years between 2012 and 2016, but also to get to the point where I couldn't even fight for a medal in the final. Like if I had messed up in the final, you know, maybe I would have felt better, but I didn't even get the chance to compete for that medal. And I was distraught. I felt like I was torn apart. I'd never felt so upset and broken in all of my life. And it was just it was one of the hardest things to come to terms with. And I remember meeting up with Lance, my husband, right after that competition. And he just said to me, like, Tom, maybe this isn't where your story ends. Maybe you weren't meant to win an Olympic gold medal here today, because maybe your future child was meant to see you win an Olympic gold medal. And then, you know, and at the time I was like, no, it's never going to be. I'm rubbish. I'm not going to be able to do it. Because at that time I put all of my self-worth in how well I did in diving.
Yeah.
I justified myself as a diver. And I think then becoming a parent allowed me the perspective to see that I'm more than just a diver. I'm so many other things, and I have other things that I like to look like, that I'm interested in and that I like to do and I look forward to outside of diving. And then to think that, you know, at the next Olympics in Tokyo 2020, I won an Olympic gold medal and my son got to see me do it, which is...
That's amazing.
Yeah, it feels really cool to be able to know that my son was alive while I got to do the best thing that I've ever achieved in sport.
It's a beautiful story. And you mentioned visualization. I know you said initially you didn't want to take it on board, but was there a point where you started to actually visualize you winning the gold medal, your son being...
Yeah.
I mean, did you visualize that?
Yeah. I mean, I've used visualization in different ways and in different forms for a very long time. Originally, mindfulness for me was something that I was just like, how is this going to help? Like, I don't have time for this. It's not going to help me. Like, I just need to focus on diving, training. And it was in 2016 that I started to do mindfulness and breathing work, which ended up helping me tremendous amounts building into the next Olympics. But for visualization, I first drew a picture of me doing a handstand with the Olympic rings, and I wrote London 2012 on it when I was 9 years old.
Wow.
While London was still a candidate city. And it was like, I drew that picture wanting to compete at the Olympics in front of a home crowd. And it was like manifesting what I wanted to happen. And I visualized that every single day. Since 9 years old, I visualized myself doing the dives that I thought I was going to be doing in 2012. I ended up learning harder dives, but I was visualizing over and over again. And every day of my life up until 2020, I was visualizing those dives. I was visualizing doing them the best that I could. And initially starting with visualization, I used to be terrible at it because things would go wrong. If I was in a bad mood, things would go wrong in my diving visualizations. And what I had to learn to do was that if anything started going wrong at any moment in the dive, stop it and start again. And just to the point where I got to a place with visualization where I could visualize all my dives and they would all be perfect.
Wow.
And if you visualize them enough and enough and enough, you get to a point where that's all you can imagine. That's the only way you can imagine yourself doing those dives. And just imagining ourselves winning that gold medal, and in particular in the synchro event, because I felt we only started, Matty, Lee and I only started doing synchro in 2018. And from that moment, I saw something in the way that we were doing synchro. And I was like, you know what? This could be it. This could be our chance at winning an Olympic gold medal. And there was lots of times that we'd won medals and we were like, okay, you know, that's great. Yeah, medal, fine, whatever. But it was really in the year of 2020 and through lockdown, I got to see a different side of myself and also a different side of Matty, of realizing that all of that distraction was taken away from us, because all the only thing that we could actually do was train and dive and focus on what we needed to do. And we had more time than ever to do it. And it was just every day we would just do whatever we could to make sure that everything we did was a step closer to winning an Olympic gold medal. All those little 1%, all of those little things that you think, oh, that's not going to make a difference. Oh, like, is that really going to help? But once you start doing all of those little bits that you find that help you, it allows you to, all those little 1% add up to become 10%. And that's how you make that little difference above your competitors.
Exactly. And that doesn't only apply to, you know, world-class athletes like yourself. And I think everyone can use that kind of approach in their lives. Just small little bits of improvement each day lead up to big change over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the big, big thing for me is mindfulness or some form of meditation or breathing work, because I find that even if I do 10 minutes of it in the morning, you know, it doesn't have to be an hour long thing. It doesn't, you know, even if you have 1 minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever time you have, just to be able to take to reset. I liken mindfulness and meditation like almost like going to the bank for your brain. You go there to take out the coins and take out all of the things that you need to be able to deal with your day. And the great thing about this bank is that you can go back to it at any moment in time in the day, and there's always something there to be able to take from it and draw into the next thing that you're going to do. And I also use it, you know, with the knitting that I do now, I also use that as a bit of a mindfulness and a reset.
Definitely.
Between each thing that I do in the day, between each meeting or an interview or whatever it may be, between each thing, I will either do like a breathing thing for 5 minutes, or I will do sit down and knit for 10 minutes, whatever it is. I will do something to kind of reset, so that whether something previously has been good or bad, I don't take any of that with me to the next thing, and try and create... Within a day, there's lots of independent events. And just because something hasn't gone right at the beginning of your day doesn't mean that your whole day is, you know, going to go into turmoil. It's about allowing yourself to leave each thing as an independent event and move on to the next thing, knowing that you've got the power to make it the best that it can be.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, that's real practical advice for everyone. You know, in the working world, we jump from one meeting to the next, and you literally, your energy is just going down, 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 your mental energy, your physical energy. But if we just take time, a few minutes to, like you say, reset, to restore a bit of active recovery, it could be simple as breathing, could be simple as literally just even staring at a wall, doing knitting, whatever works for you, you then are literally allowing yourself to restore again. You can encounter the next thing with more energy, more focus, more presence.
Yeah, I think that's the key to everything, because, you know, lots of people think being busy and working hard is just going and not stopping. But I think the biggest thing that I've learned, especially in my diving career, is being kind to yourself, being kind and allowing yourself to, if things don't go right for you on a certain point, don't be too hard on yourself, because as soon as you're too hard on yourself, then you're wasting all this energy being like, feeling like you've let yourself down, when actually just being, allowing yourself to be like, you know what, yeah, I made that mistake, but I'm not going to do it again, and then moving on and allowing yourself to make mistakes, because if you went through life without making mistakes or worrying about making mistakes, you're going to make more.
Definitely.
Whereas sometimes if you can let go about worrying about failing, that's when you can really get the best out of everything.
Definitely. Self-compassion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So like with your peak performance, with being one of the best, or being the best in the world at what you do, the success that comes with that, the fame, the platform, I mean, you have 3.4 million followers on Instagram. I'm curious to know how that plays out in your life. I can imagine it could be a double-edged sword. There's probably some positives, some negatives, but tell us what it's like having that many people know who you are, the impact it has on you. But then also, like, how you, do you have any way of approaching that in terms of like having a positive impact or any influence you'd like to to have on others?
Yeah, I think there's lots of things. Well, I mean, as an athlete, I think there's lots of things when it comes to social media, because it can be a bit of a black hole of, you know, it can be a really happy place, but it can also be quite a, you know, disheartening place. The big thing that I do with my social media, before all else, before I post anything or whatever, I try to curate my social media as a place that inspires me, or it makes me laugh, or it makes me happy. And as soon as I follow anyone or see anything that I don't feel inspires me to be either creative with knitting, or inspires me to go out and work hard in diving, or makes me laugh, then I get rid of it. I take, like, unfollow, or I block, or whatever I need to do to be able to keep my social media, because that's the only thing that you can really control is in terms of what you see. Of course, you're going to have comments and things like that that come up on your social media, and I try not to read any of those, and I try not to get, you know, I'm just like, you know, whatever, I'm just going to post what I want to post and what makes me happy, because as long as my friends and family are happy and healthy, that's like that, and I'm doing the best that I can be the best person, then I'm happy. But then also there is a responsibility of, I feel, as a member of the LGBT community to spread, I don't know, some kind of positivity, be visible for any young people that are feeling like they are less than, feeling like they don't fit in, and feeling like they don't have a place in this world, to be able to show that you can be whoever you want to be. You can achieve whatever you want to achieve with hard work. You know, I'm not saying that if you put all of your hard work in that you will succeed, because that's not a guaranteed thing. But you have just, everybody has just as much of a right to those dreams as anyone. And I think, you know, being a queer athlete is something that, being able to see that and know that, because when I was younger, there weren't really any out athletes that were at the highest level of sport. Often it was like towards the end of careers or once people had retired. So for me, it was about trying to figure out, you know, how best to help other people. And I think the main thing was just to be visible. And, you know, my husband and my son and I are an LGBT family, and I share that on social media not for any other reason other than, you know, maybe one day some young person might feel like their dream of having a family one day, or their dream of being able to be successful in sport or business or whatever it could be, is possible. And, you know, I'd like to think, and, you know, there are so many LGBT athletes around the world that are doing that, that are stepping out, that are being visible, which I think is going to give hope to a lot of athletes and a lot of young people all around the world. You know, there's lots of places that I was daunted about going to initially when I came out, like, for example, like Russia. And I didn't go initially. And then I realized that actually going there, competing as an out athlete and winning medals there might, you know, there might be a young person there that feels like they weren't ever going to get involved in sport, or weren't going to get involved in what they wanted to do because they felt like they were never going to fit in. And trying to spread the message of a sport is a place for everyone, for women, for LGBT people, for any kind of ability, disability, race, gender, sexual orientation, whatever it may be, there's a place for everyone in sport. And I think that is the most important message that I think should come above all else when it comes to getting people into sport.
Definitely. I mean, what you're describing there, I mean, sounds like what this podcast is about, which is flourishing. It's like, you know, in the psychological literature, flourishing, it's emotional well-being and psychological well-being and social well-being. But if you make it a bit more human, it's feeling like you belong, feeling like you're appreciated by the people in society around you, that you have the opportunity to express your strengths in the world and be your, like, full glorious self, and be a force of good in the world. So that speaks to what you're describing here. So you said the word, you used the word hope in what you just spoke about. Do you have the hope, or do you believe that even beyond sport, that society can reach a place where everyone has that opportunity?
I'd like to think so. There is a long way to go. But there are lots of, and I think it's about people not being silent about things. And being able to speak up when they think things aren't right. Being able to call people out on the microaggressions when it comes to racism or homophobia, transphobia. Because at the end of the day, like, you've just got to, if you take anything and you have, if you only have one point of view, in something,
yeah,
then you're only going to get, there's only going to be, there's going to plateau, and there's not going to be any creativity in the world, and everything's exactly. going to stay the same. Being able to have all of these points of view and bringing to the table all genders, all races, all sexual orientations, all, you know, financial income, whatever it may be, bringing everyone together and all of these different points of view and all these different lived experiences is going to be able to create the most creative world. It's going to have the most innovation, because there's going to be all of these different ways of seeing things and doing things that is going to, and I think that's what's going to create the best world, is definitely. To have all of those different points of view, all of these bridges being built to between communities to work together as one,
yeah,
and stop dividing, stop pushing people away, stop being, you know, like trying to work together with everyone. And, you know, that's going to take a long time. I yeah. think that's going to be yeah. multi-generations, but it will, I'm hopeful that it will get to that place.
Definitely. I mean, it'll take a long time,
yeah,
but I think it's really important to hold that as, you know, might sound idealistic, but it's important to hold that kind of vision in Absolutely. Our hearts and in our minds, you know.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the more that, you know, because it always goes in, you know, ebbs and flows of like, we're making progress, and then all of a sudden there'll be a really, you know, a law that is going to really discriminate against a yeah. certain group of people, and being able to constantly push back against it. And, you know, as long as we're keeping going up in the right direction, I think that's the key to keep moving forward. And
yeah.
don't get complacent with things, because if we get complacent, then things will change and go backwards.
Yeah.
So just being able to always be mindful about how inclusive and what the things that we're saying, and, you know, we're not always going to be right, and yeah. We are always going to be constantly learning and accepting that, and understanding that you might have said things in the past, or you might have done things in the past, which may not have been right. But what are you doing right now in order to make that better? What Definitely. Are you doing to actually help make the world a better place?
Definitely. I mean, there are systemic factors at play, but what I'm hearing from you here is that we each as individuals like have a really important role to play in, I mean, it's obvious, but in changing the world, just in how we show up each day, our ability to welcome and honor different perspectives, to speak out when we think people are being oppressed or not included, you know, just that kind of stuff can over time at a micro level create macro change. If we all start to adopt and live those kinds of values, you know, compassion, openness, inclusivity, I mean, that kind of stuff, that's what we need to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think, like, a sense of empathy, of like figuring yeah. out, like, you know, when people are having a tough time, or if, you know, being able to put yourself in other people's shoes sometimes can really help give a sense of perspective, but yeah. also understanding that there's certain groups of people that we will never be able to understand their lived experience. You know, I can never pretend to understand the lived experience of a trans person or a person of color, but being able to listen, try to understand and try to learn, you know, can help, I think is the key to it. And I think that also comes down to school and being able to learn the histories of all of these different people, the marginalized people. It's not just being able to learn the histories of triumphs and battles and how Britain's become this amazing nation. I mean, you know, actually it's like kind of gross what Britain's done over the years, and being able to actually learn the harsh truths about that, I think is what is going to have give people a better understanding of why people feel the way they do.
Definitely. Yeah, it's important that we have these bold, courageous, open, honest conversations.
Absolutely, yeah.
You've covered so much great stuff today, so thank you. We are nearing the end, but I'd love to ask you, you've lived an extraordinary life, and by that I mean out of the ordinary compared to the average person, but you're still a human being at the end of the day. You've obviously learned lessons along the way, and you know, you seem to have acquired wisdom through all your experiences as well. So if you had to encapsulate what you have learned through your career, through your life, in, you know, a sentence or two, however you would like to express that, what would that be like? And maybe think about how this could be of value to other people out there.
Gosh, big question.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many things that I've learned over my diving career. I still think that the biggest thing that allows everyone to do the best that they can and allows people to flourish is having a sense of perspective. Because quite often we can build things up to be really overwhelming and big problems and the be all and end all of everything. But sometimes just being able to take the step back, look at how far you've come, and being able to have this understanding that whatever happens, you will be able to wake up the next morning and get back to it and try again. And nothing is ever going to be perfect. Nothing is ever going to just be plain sailing all the way. There's going to be bumps in the road. There's going to be changes, and there's going to be obstacles thrown in your way. But being able to take a step back, give yourself a sense of perspective, and allow yourself to continue and keep moving forward against all odds is how you will end up being able to get closer and closer to achieving your dreams.
Amazing. Tom, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Join us next time for another episode and another brilliant guest. Flourish is a podcast from Unmind, the mental health platform transforming the world of workplace well-being. To find out more, visit unmind.com or follow us on socials at UnmindHQ. You can also find me, your host, on Instagram at Steve@Unmind. See you next time.